From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Marlon Brando is the subject of two new big books about his life and work. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the director who discovered him, Aaliyah Kazan. He directed Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. 25 films have been added to the Library of Congress National Film Registry. One of them is Taxi Driver. We'll feature an interview about the film with the screenwriter Paul Schrader. Hey, Stella, are you talking to me? And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Star Trek Generations, the seventh in a fleet of Star Trek films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. 13 people have died from today's shooting in front of a Gaza mosque. Palestinian police clashed with Islamic militants today. Witnesses say the police started shooting at thousands of worshippers outside the mosque after Hamas supporters threw bottles and rocks at them. A police statement says some militants also shot at PLO forces before the officers responded. About 150 people have been hurt. Police say some 300 militants have been arrested. Curfews have been imposed on parts of Gaza City. The Commerce Department says the merchandise trade deficit rose 4.6% in September to just over $10 billion. The U.S. appears headed for the second-worst trade gap in history this year. Analyst David Litman says the trade deficit will likely smooth out eventually.
The trade figures continue to be a little on the weak side. I think this will change around now that we have, for the first time in 4 years, an international recovery underway as the other nations gain economic strength. And because of our interest rate increases, our economy slows down. I think we'll see the trade balance turn in our favor after mid-year 1995.
The trade gap with China soared in September to a record $3.5 billion. Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota claims that he has enough votes to win the race for leader of the Senate Democrats, next year's minority party. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
Daschle needs 24 votes to win and says he has 25. His opponent, Chris Dodd of Connecticut, says Dodd has about 20 and says he hopes to get senators whose commitment to Daschle Dodd considers soft. Daschle says he regards his 25 as firm. He claims conservatives, including Bro Exon and Graham, and liberals, including Levin and Harkin. Daschle is perceived as more liberal than Dodd and is so rated by several organizations. Daschle does not agree with that. Independent observers say it's still a horse race. They note that the vote is by secret ballot and that on some past occasions, promised votes have not materialized. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Produce prices are going up because of Tropical Storm Gordon, which has just been downgraded from a hurricane. Gordon's high winds and torrential rains wiped out an estimated $200 million worth of Florida crops. Much of the country's winter produce comes from that state. Florida's agriculture commissioner says much of America's Thanksgiving dinner is underwater. He has asked Governor Lawton Childs to seek a disaster declaration from the U.S. Agriculture Department. One Florida state official says a bushel of peppers that sold for a little less than $11 last week costs $30 today. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 13 points to end at 3,815. Declines led advances by a margin of 7-4 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The United Nations says it's found evidence that the Bosnian Serbs have used napalm and cluster bombs in their air raid on the northwestern town of Bihać. The UN says it doesn't have any evidence yet of casualties. The United Nations has threatened to call in NATO air power if the UN-declared safe zone of Bihać is attacked, but no request apparently was made. Serbian forces are pressing on Bihać in a strong counterattack to the Bosnian government's recent territorial gains. Microsoft has introduced a new online service. Rival companies charge the new service is anti-competitive, and they would like the Justice Department to look into it. Bill Radke of member station KUOW reports from Seattle.
When Microsoft Chair Bill Gates this week unveiled Network, the company's new online information service, the leading online providers hoped the Justice Department was listening. Microsoft will sell the new service along with next year's version of Windows. Network will be preloaded on virtually every Intel-based personal computer sold. Rivals such as America Online, CompuServe, and Prodigy say if you can only get network by buying Windows 95, that might be viewed as anti-competitive. Microsoft can also use network to find out marketing information about its users. And analysts say Microsoft will probably charge significantly less money for network than other online users pay. The Justice Department is already looking into Microsoft's attempt to buy Intuit, maker of Quicken, the leading personal finance software. At this week's Comdex conference in Las Vegas, Bill Gates shrugged off suggestions that network could also prompt an investigation. Gates suggested that his competitors are just jealous. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Radke in Seattle.
The Baseball Players Union is expected to respond to the owner's tax plan today in negotiations. The plan is built around a tax on teams with payrolls above the major league average. The deal would also eliminate salary arbitration for younger players. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are two new books about Marlon Brando, a biography and an autobiography. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring an interview with Alia Kazan, the director who helped make Brando a star. Kazan directed Brando in the stage and screen versions of A Streetcar Named Desire and the film On the Waterfront. Kazan also discovered James Dean and directed him in East of Eden. At the start of Kazan's career in the 1930s, he worked with the Group Theater, where he learned the style of acting that became known as the Method. He later co-founded the Actors Studio with Lee Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends never forgave him for naming names during the McCarthy era. Kazan broke his silence on the subject in his 1988 autobiography. I spoke with him after the book was published. We opened, of course, with this scene from Streetcar.
Hey, shut up!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my clothes out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law on
you. Hey, Stella!
You get a woman and then call her back because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, Eunice.
I'll say haul you in and turn a fire hose on you.
I want my girls down here.
You stinker.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to talk with you specifically about some of the movies you've directed and some of the scenes within those films. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played it like a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous and he was marvelous in it. And that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, untold numbers of people. What went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Many, many things with him, many, many times with him, he was ahead of me. That is, he understood what I said and understood it better than I said it. And I hardly had to tell him anything. Once I said, you fall on your knees, and he did. And that's all there was to it.
How many takes did you do of that scene?
How many takes did I do? I think 2.
And you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't mistake it, could you, really? That tone of voice, I mean, people have imitated it and shouted it and spin on comedy shows and everything. It's just once in a decade a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough. And he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, in the contract, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliate him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid. And I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it before you do.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly. When he says taking dives, Palookaville, all that, and it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation.
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation too. I feel brotherly towards them.
Would you describe the meeting with James Dean that made you realize he had something?
I went to see a play of his, and a friend of mine named Paul Osborne had recommended him to me. And I went to see him in a play. He played a part of an Arab, a small part, and I didn't think much of him. But I thought, just to please Paul, I'd ask him to come into Warner Brothers office. And I went in there that day, and there he was, like a pile of rags in a corner, all bent over, scrunched up, and so on. I thought, well, he didn't even get up, didn't look at me, didn't get up. And so I went in the office and thought, well, I'll make the son of a bitch wait a little bit, it'll do him good. So anyway, finally I called him into the office, and he came in, and he didn't say anything. He was not a talker. So finally he didn't say a damn thing, and I said, well? And he said, you want to go for a ride with me on my motorbike? So I said, God, I hate motorbikes. I didn't say it to him, but I do hate motorbikes. I think they're a menace. And I said, all right, Jimmy, well, let's go. So I went downstairs, and he got his motorbike and unlatched it or unchained it or whatever he did. And I got in the back, and he rode me around the middle of the city. And it was like he was showing that a country boy can defy the city and defy the rules of the city. He zigzagged in and out. I didn't want to ruin my relationship as a director by saying, Jimmy, I'm frightened, cut it out. I was frightened. But anyway, we finally both lived.
I want to play a scene from this movie. And this is a scene where, well, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors. The son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
That's for you. And it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. And that's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
No, British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody. That we paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over market for that stuff.
Cal, I signed my name. And boys go out, and some die, and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? But I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but...
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. And it served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
If James Dean had more technique as an actor, if he had been more experienced, would it have been unnecessary to play up that antagonism in real life between Dean and Massey?
It wouldn't have hurt. Terry. The truth is it wouldn't have hurt. Everybody's so chummy on a stage set, you know. Everybody gets coffee and gets flattered and everything else, and very soon they lose the sense of what they... a very driving emotion underneath the scene. They become comfortable. Comfortable is not good when an actor gets too... and stays away from everybody and stays, you know, just is flattered and has his girlfriend there too. God knows what goes on. You know, it's better to irritate them a little bit so they're on edge. I mean, it's very serious business, a emotional film.
We're featuring a 1988 interview with director Alia Kazan. Back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring an interview with director Alia Kazan. You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside, and finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him or a big brother to him, and I looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
Let's talk more about acting and your style of directing. Now, you were a member of the group theater in the mid-30s and a co-founder of the Actor Studio. These are the two places where what's been called the Method was born. How would you describe the Method, and do you think of yourself as subscribing to it?
The method has to do with retreat from artificial emotionalism, where emotion is conveyed by signs and gestures and voice patterns and so forth, but where it's where on the other hand it's actually felt by the actor. He actually feels it, the emotion that he's portraying. It's there in him. And there are techniques which are obvious. They're not so complicated and not so mysterious for arousing emotion by remembering certain things in yourself so that the scene becomes, in a sense, a part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as directing with the method, with that method?
I think I do, yes. I think I try to get the real thing out of actors, and I try to stop them from in what we call indicating or gesturing, suggesting a scene by the way they are. In England, they do it. They do it differently. The voice is very important there, and the way they, they have different kinds of plays there. And I don't think that I'm any good to direct Shakespeare or George Bernard Shaw or any play that depends on the way lines are read. I think I'm only good when somehow or other the play relates to my own experience.
And to the experience of the actor who's playing it.
That's correct.
Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings
right.
In the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it, and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always... hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And, for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors were really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, you know, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family and my work. Those are the two things I have. And I thought, why should I give up my my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. And if people who are communists are still are going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it, I also feel that, then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who've never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry. I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Have you had second thoughts about the choice you made?
Not really, no. I think I wish they'd done it. I wish they'd named me. I think if the whole bunch of us had come out and said, we did have a communist cell, so what? I don't think they would have been worse off. I think it would have been clear the air. But, of course, except for the three I did talk to, they didn't do it.
I want to get to something you say at the very, very end of your book. You say that when you die, you don't want a big memorial shindig with lots of speeches. You want a big party, but no speeches, and you want everyone that you've ever known invited, including even your enemies, if they're still alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you want that?
Well, because I really am an old-fashioned family-type Mediterranean man. I do like my family enormously. I have a great big family. I have five grandchildren, one more on the way. I have five children. I have stepchildren. I have all kinds of friends that I've had through the years. Not alienated, the opposite. They've become closer and closer. And I just want to say to them, thank you very much for what you've given me in the way of experience and happiness. And here, have a party. And there are all my sweaters and books and things. Help yourself.
You've left money in your will for this party.
Yep.
Why do you want all your enemies to come?
Why not? Then I don't feel about them. I mean, things heal, don't they, after a while? I think so. Anyway, I don't have any bad feeling about anybody. I'm very happy at the moment. I'm very proud of this book. I think it's a landmark kind of book, so I'm proud I did it. I also did it before I got too old to remember anything, so I'm glad I did that, too.
Okay. I bet you wish you could be around to watch this party when it happens.
I would, yes. I would. I hope there's good liquor there, that's all. I hope nobody gets a hangover.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You've been very nice.
Director Alia Kazan recorded in 1988 after the publication of his autobiography. His latest book, the novel Beyond the Aegean, was recently published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The film Taxi Driver is one of 25 movies that were just added to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Coming up on this archive edition, we feature a 1988 interview with Paul Schrader about writing the screenplay. Schrader says he was almost living the life of Taxi Driver's main character, Travis Bickle. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Star Trek Generations, which stars the two actors who are at the helm of Starship Enterprise, William Shatner and Patrick Stewart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Palestinian Authority and Islamic militants are trading accusations over today's violence in Gaza. 13 people are now said to have died in clashes between demonstrators and police, and up to 150 people have been wounded. A senior leader of the Islamic group Hamas claims PLO leader Yasser Arafat planned the attack. Arafat has been under Israeli pressure to rein in the militants. The Hamas leader says Arafat must have lost his mind by letting police fire on Muslim crowds. But Palestinian police insist armed Hamas activists fired on them first. Coastal North Carolina residents may be seeing the last of Gordon, which has now been downgraded to a tropical storm. But weather officials are still maintaining a wait-and-see attitude. George Olson of member station WTEB reports from New Bern, North Carolina.
National Weather Service meteorologists are holding out hope that coastal North Carolina has seen the worst of Hurricane Gordon. The storm is currently stalled about 110 miles southeast of Morehead City, and the most recent satellite photos indicate some movement away from the coast. Dan Bartoff with the Newport National Weather Service office.
Latest indications from our radar and the satellite pictures are that it has begun a movement more towards the southeast or south, away from this area.
These photos also indicate a general weakening in the storm, but Weather Service officials will wait for further satellite confirmation before declaring the threat over. In the meantime, coastal residents are dealing with flooding problems. Gordon has pushed the sea through the dunes in some spots on Nag's Head, with sand piled as high as 15 inches deep on roadways. For National Public Radio, I'm George Olson in New Bern, North Carolina.
Russia's defense minister has confronted his country's legislature. The lawmakers have said they would fire him if they could. NPR's Brooke Gladstone reports from Moscow.
Many members of Russia's lower house, the Duma, have said they would fire Defense Minister Pavel Grachev if they had the power, but they don't. That belongs to President Boris Yeltsin. So today, instead, they grilled him with questions ranging from hazing to military spending to START II to the murder of a journalist investigating army corruption. In response, Grachev looked composed, even cheerful. "I am clean before the army," he said, "and I will not leave on my own." So far, the Russian president has stood by the minister who stood by him during the parliamentary uprising last year. Some lawmakers favor a non-binding vote of confidence on the minister, hoping it will influence the president to make a move that many see as inevitable. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
The Associated Press is quoting sources who say the United States is thinking about sending up to $5 billion in military help to the Bosnian government. This could also include a program of military training for the Bosnian government army. The AP says the officials say all military aid discussions are preliminary. On Wall Street, the Dow has fallen more than 18 points to 3,809. This is NPR. The Associated Press reports Republican members of the House have more money saved up because they share their campaign war chests. The AP analyzed 16 close House races. They found that 64 GOP incumbents donated money to their colleagues. The Republican won in every case. The donation stemmed from a strong request last October from Congressman Newt Gingrich. Much of the giving was in the final days of campaigning. The money injection was apparently a small part of the total contributions for those candidates, but it was crucial. In 11 of the 16 races, the Democratic candidate entered the final 3 weeks of the campaign with more money. The insurance company for ice cream manufacturer Schwan's has paid almost $1 million to consumers who were sickened after eating the company's ice cream. It was tainted with salmonella. Bill Kaplan of member station, or rather of Minnesota Public Radio, reports from St. Paul.
Under agreements signed so far, more than 6,000 customers will be paid an average of $158 for medical and other expenses In return, they agree not to sue. Another 7,000 consumers have agreed not to sue after accepting gift certificates or no compensation at all. Attorneys bringing a class-action lawsuit asked a court to block Schwann's from pursuing further agreements with consumers, but the request was denied. Company spokesman Dave Jennings says Schwann's is treating customers fairly.
We are proceeding in precisely the way that our society expects a good corporate citizen to proceed, and that we're doing everything humanly possible to identify people who have a claim and to settle that claim with them.
Jennings says it's not clear how many more customers might seek compensation. An estimated 32,000 people consumed contaminated ice cream. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Catlin in St. Paul.
The militant Islamic group Jihad says it's organizing a suicide battalion to attack Israeli troops. The group's leader says suicide attacks are planned to avenge the November 2nd car bombing death of another Jihad leader. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Taxi Driver is one of 25 films that were added this week to the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. The registry, which was established in 1988, now has 150 films that have been selected for preservation at the Library of Congress. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1988 interview with Paul Schrader, who wrote the screenplay for Taxi Driver, which was directed by Martin Scorsese. Schrader also wrote the screenplays for Scorsese's Raging Bull and The Last Temptation of Christ, and directed the films Blue Collar, Hardcore, American Gigolo, Patty Hearst, The Comfort of Strangers, and Light Sleeper. He directed a new HBO movie called Witch Hunt, which premieres on HBO December 10th. Taxi Driver was Schrader's first collaboration with Scorsese. After Schrader saw Scorsese's film Mean Streets, he knew he wanted Scorsese to direct Taxi Driver. Schrader told me what he saw in Mean Streets that made him think Scorsese had the right sensibility for Taxi Driver.
It's just a passion, you know, and also the perversity, you know, someone who is willing to grab the thing, put it between his teeth, bite hard and run, you know. I don't want to use words we can't use on language, but someone who has the guts to do it.
Now, in Taxi Driver, your screenplay is about a lonely, alienated, psychopathic taxi driver. You've described the taxi as the perfect metaphor for loneliness, a man driving around the city in a steel coffin. And his alienation erupts into a bloody killing spree at the end of the movie, which he thinks of, in heroic terms, he thinks he's helping to clean the city of the pimps and the filth. I want to play from
What's interesting about that is, in the film, he fixates on two women, one of whom he can have and one of whom he can't, and of course he wants the one he can't and doesn't want the one he can. And out of this dilemma, he decides to kill the father figure of the good girl, who is a politician. And when he cannot do that, he fails, he kills the father figure of the bad girl, who's the prostitute. And what's interesting, in his mind, there's really not much difference. They're both, there's these competing father figures. It's just that in society's mind, of course, he becomes a hero because one of them was a pimp and not a politician.
Sounds a little Freudian. Were you in Freudian analysis at the time?
No, subsequently.
Okay. Well, you wrote the journal, the diary, for Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, which De Niro just gives a brilliant reading of in the movie. I want to play some of that, and this is from the record, so it's excerpts edited together from the film. Mm-hmm. So this is Robert De Niro over a score by Bernard Herrmann with the screenplay by my guest Paul Schrader from Taxi Driver.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week. Sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some won't even take spooks. Don't make no difference to me. Each night when I return the cab to the garage, I have to clean the back seat. Some nights I clean off the blood. 12 hours of work and I still can't sleep. Damn. Days go on and on. They don't end. All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
The tone of writing in that seems so perfect for the character. How did you know, not being a psychopath yourself, how did you know the tone of voice to get for this? It just seems just right.
Well, I wrote that script in 10 days, in two drafts. It jumped out of my head like an animal. And so it was a really cri de coeur. It was a cry from my heart. I've fallen into a difficult period in Los Angeles where I was living in my car and just sort of driving around. And having a lot of trouble sleeping. And finally I got a pain in my stomach, which turned out to be an ulcer, and I went to the hospital. And then while I was talking to a nurse in emergency, I realized I hadn't spoken to anyone in several weeks. And when I was in the hospital, I realized that that's what I was. I was like a taxi driver. I was like this person who was floating around in this car. And I got out of the hospital, and I wrote that script, like I said, in 10 days.
Let's get back to the tone that you actually wrote it in. There's something almost Old Testament about the tone. Someday a real rain will come along and wash all the scum off the streets. But that's that apocalyptic sense.
Yeah, I really, you know, that was my first real script. I'd done one thing before. And I didn't know how you were supposed to write scripts yet.
Did it scare you that you were able to so authentically and so intuitively capture a psychopathic voice?
Well, you know, it scared me that I was at that place at that time. I mean, the person who wrote that script is long gone, and I don't even know if I would recognize him if I saw him.
What was your reaction when Hinckley said that he was... He had seen Taxi Driver, and he wanted to impress Jodie Foster by attempting to assassinate
the
president.
I was in New Orleans at the time, scouting locations, and it came over the radio that this kid had tried to kill Reagan. And he was from Colorado, sort of a white bread kid. And I said to the person sitting next to me, I said, it's one of those Taxi Driver kids. And I got back to the hotel, and the FBI was waiting for me. And in fact, it was one of those Taxi Driver kids. You know, the film didn't create them. They exist before the film and after the film, and they attach themselves to many things. More. You know, it's just actually sort of rare that they attach themselves to a good film. More likely, they attach themselves to things like advertising.
Mm-hmm. You said that you are no longer the same person who wrote Taxi Driver. That you don't really have those feelings anymore. At that time, I think you were really motivated by certain demons, by alienation, by loneliness. You're now married, you're a father, and I figure loneliness wouldn't have the same pull on you that it did then. Are there different things that motivate you now in your writing, or even different demons that drive you?
Yes, certainly. And you miss those old demons, you know, boy, because those are powerful engines, and they really drive you hard. It was actually easier to write then because you had no choice. You were just trying to keep the demons from swallowing you up. So today it's a little more difficult. You have to use your imaginative powers and your creative skills to a greater degree.
What kind of compromise do you feel that you have been or have had to make in your career between writing screenplays that fit your vision, that communicate the ideas that you're interested in, and you really do communicate ideas in your screenplays, and making something that's actually saleable?
Well, I mean, I want to communicate. You know, the movie business is the business of mass communication. If you're not interested in mass communication, you shouldn't be in this business. So, you know, you, whatever your personal visions are, you have to put them in the seat alongside the idea of mass communication. So it's just not possible to say, I don't care who sees this movie. And so I try to think of things in commercial terms. You know, how will people want to see and hear this? And so I don't avoid that. However, it is not possible to escape the idiosyncrasies of your own psychology. I remember when I did Cat People years ago, and I said to myself, now I'm going to do a film that is not personal. I'm going to do a genre movie, a horror movie, a special effects film. It's not going to be about me at all. Well, I look back now at that film, I think it's more personal than any of the others.
In what ways?
I just feel that the character of the zookeeper is really me. And when I set out to make the film, I didn't think that at all. So you can't really escape yourself.
We're featuring a 1988 interview from our archives with Paul Schrader. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. Schrader was brought up in a strict Calvinist home. In fact, as a young man, he had planned to become a minister. I spoke with him in 1988.
Now, there used to be a ban in your church against seeing movies. Does that ban still exist?
No. I think that they have made that a matter of individual conscience now. It banned what they called worldly amusements, which included things like card playing and smoking and drinking and dancing and theater attendance. And this came out of Prohibition days. The ban was actually instituted in 1928. I once, as a child rather, impassionately queried my mother about this. I think I wanted to see some Disney film. She said to me, it doesn't matter. The quality of the film doesn't matter. It's the industry that is evil. And so I think that was the position.
Did you have a sense of what you were missing?
No. And I'm actually very happy about having missed all those.
No, really? Come on.
Well, yeah, because, really? Because you know, you are imprinted as an artist or as a person by, you know, how you come to a specific field. And I came to films as a college student, and the first films I really saw or paid serious attention to were films by Bergman or Buñuel, Antonioni, Bresson. And that was my original imprinting in films. And my peers and Coivals, you know, were imprinted with Westerns and Disney films. And when they say, I want to make the movies that I loved when I was a child, they think about those films. And when I say that, I don't think about those films. I think about, you know, the kind of childhood background and about the films I first came to love. I came to films as an adult and then later learned to love them as a child. So it has given me a unique perspective and a unique place in this business, and I've never really worried about anyone doing what I'm doing because no one has my perspective.
What's the first film you saw and what effect did it have on you?
Well, actually, the first film was a Disney film. Was Absent-Minded Professor. And I snuck...
Is that the one with Jerry Lewis or is that the Nutty Professor?
That's the Nutty Professor. This is the one with Fred McMurray.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the one about Flubber.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I snuck into the balcony, and I sat there watching this, and I was wondering what all this fuss was about. And then about a year later, a friend of mine took me to see Wild in the Country with Elvis Presley and Tuesday Weld. And I sat there, and I realized, aha, this is why they don't want me to go. Here's the problem.
And what effect did that have on you, seeing that?
Well, I had developed a mad crush on Tuesday Weld.
And did that make you feel bad?
No, it made me want to see more movies.
Yeah, so what made you so passionate about movies?
Well, you know, it was a very luxurious forbidden fruit. I mean, not only could you be a rebel and do something that upset your elders, but you could also wear the mantle of respectability while you were doing it. It was like having your cake and eating it. It was a rare opportunity, you know, to be a rebel without it, you know, having to do things like break into cars.
Several of your films, like Patty and Hardcore, are in their way about leaving the family and about breaking away, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from what your life has been. When you left your home and when you broke away from the church, was that a wrenching experience for you?
No. I mean, it was more like the way a bullet must feel when it's finally discharged from a gun.
You want to explain that?
Well, I've been waiting a long time to get out of there, and I came out with a bang, you know, and I took off and didn't look back.
Paul Schrader recorded in 1988. He wrote the screenplay for Taxi Driver, which was one of 25 films added this week to the Library of Congress National Film Registry. Schrader directed a new film for HBO called Witch Hunt, which premieres December 10th. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the latest military action in northwest Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. Air attacks today by Serb forces against the safe area of Bihać. The UN says that even napalm was used, but apparently nobody was injured in that attack. I'll talk with NPR's Tom Jelton, who's in Croatia, about the drastic changes in the war just this week. Also, deadly demonstrations today in Gaza, a series of clashes between Palestinian supporters of Hamas and the Palestinian police. Many have been killed and scores have been wounded. We'll have a discussion of the music of S.E. Rogi from Sierra Leone, and Bob Mondello reviews the new American film by a French director. It's called The Professional.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Star Trek Generations is the seventh Star Trek movie, but the first to include the cast of the syndicated series Star Trek The Next Generation. A lot of that show's episodes were directed by David Carson, who also directed the new film. Even though he's never directed a feature before, he ought to know the territory. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
You'll have to forgive me. I did some of the basic coursework in Star Trek, but I never got the degree, and I certainly never went on to try for a master's or PhD. Sure, I can discern Sulu from Scotty, but don't ask me anything about any of those Next Generation people, and don't even bring up that Babylon thing. Besides, I still have a lot of very basic questions. Like, why is it that whenever the Starship Enterprise crashes through some time-warping force field, and the control room starts to shake, like the camera work on NYPD Blue, why is it that nobody's wearing seatbelts? They all go crashing around the ship as though this sort of thing were some big surprise, as though it hadn't happened week after week since about the third millennium. Here's another question. Why is Whoopi Goldberg in the new Star Trek movie but not in any of the credits for it? Is she ashamed? She needn't be. Even if you don't know Data from Worf, this is one of the more entertaining recent Star Trek movies, not least because it's got plenty of plot. The year is, oh, who knows what the year is. In any case, the Enterprise has just rescued a mad scientist, played by Malcolm McDowell, from an observatory disaster. Naturally, it turns out that he's up to no good. What he likes doing is going around the universe imploding stars, even when that means millions of people, or whatever, will perish with them. Does he just like wrecking star systems? No. It seems there's this ribbon of energy floating through space. And every time McDowell does in a star, the path of the ribbon changes. McDowell wants the ribbon to come to him so he can jump right in. Why? No one knows, until Captain Picard, played by Patrick Stewart, questions the Enterprise's bartender, played by Whoopi Goldberg. She's been there.
What happened to you?
It was like being inside Joy. As if Joy was something tangible and you could wrap yourself up in it like a blanket. And never in my entire life have I ever been as content.
And then you were beamed away from there.
Pulled. Ripped away. None of us wanted to go. And I would have done anything, anything, to get back there.
Trekkies know that this kind of talk means there'll be lots of cosmic conceptualizing ahead. And sure enough, there is. The weighty question at hand is about whether an eternal life of pleasure is preferable to a life spent risking death to do good for people, or rather for beings. Fans who know just how deeply steeped in the American Puritan tradition this series is will already know which choice our heroes make. For the rest of you, suffice it to say there's plenty of the usual pseudoscientific jargon. There's a crash of the Enterprise that's expertly handled. There's some authentic humor when an android is given an emotion chip, although the humor turns to irritation when the joke goes on too long. And there is, as always, a lot of very bad acting. It's true, as you've heard, that this is the movie in which Picard meets William Shatner's Captain Kirk. And though I won't tell you how, I should say that the sight of Shatner navigating action scenes in his stiff wig, clambering daintily over rocks on some distant planet like a matron in heels, reminded me of no one so much as that other great science fiction performer, RuPaul. In short, I liked Star Trek Generations all right. I had a pleasant time, but I'm still not going for the diploma.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Our intern is Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross. Let's close the show with Leonard Bernstein's score for On the Waterfront.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.